This presentation has been previously broadcast.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio.
Okay, welcome back and thanks again for listening. The number is 888-914-9149. Odd story this morning in The New Scientist. It has to do with antidepressants leaking into waterways that can, get this, make crayfish bolder. B-O-L-D-E-R. And you're saying crayfish? What are they talking about? You know, like they're like the freshwater shrimp type things. Little crawdads, we used to call them when I was a kid. So here's the deal. Trace amounts of antidepressants washing into rivers and lakes could be making crayfish behave more boldly and disturbing their ecosystems. I'm sure you didn't roll out of bed this morning wondering about the equilibrium for crayfish and their ecosystems, but here I am with the information. Evidence has been growing that various medications can end up in waterways because they are excreted in people's urine. This includes antidepressants known as selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, which are widely used to reduce depression and anxiety, with almost 1 in 8 people taking them in the U.S. And throughout this article, there are links to the data if you want to go further. In people, these selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, for which I will now use the term SSRI because it's easier. In people, SSRIs raise levels of brain signaling chemicals called serotonin, one of them is, which is present in many animals, including crayfish. Lindsay Reisinger at the University of Florida and her colleagues wondered if they would make crayfish less fearful in the same way that drugs make humans less anxious. So her team compared crayfish behavior in 2 artificial water streams, one which had trace levels of SSRI antidepressants, and this particular one that they used here was called citalopram. When the medicine was present, the animals were nearly twice as fast to emerge from their shelters to explore their surroundings, and they also spent nearly twice as long searching for food. They spend less time hiding, and they go into a new environment more quickly, she said. The animals' greater boldness could have several effects, like making them more vulnerable to predators such as fish and wading birds. While some crayfish species are classed as invasive in some areas, others are endangered. So moral to the story here, you may say, okay, that's interesting, but kind of weird. Why are you telling me this? Here's why. Because it's not just antidepressants that get into the water system. The contraceptive pill that many women take for contraception, that too, those hormones too, pass through the urine into the water system. Now, I've had the occasion to talk to at least one engineer whose job to tend the water treatment plant at the local municipality where he lives. And I asked him, I said, does everything get filtered out? I mean, can you filter everything? He says, oh, no, we filter out certain things that we know are harmful. And we have very exacting standards of what we do to make sure that the water is clean. But no, there's all kinds of stuff that can get in the water that we don't treat for. So what that means is that these hormones that are in the contraceptive pill that women take, when those things get into the groundwater, it's also been shown that in a way similar to crayfish, these hormones and chemicals, they have deleterious effects on fish and frogs and other things that that wind up with aberrations because they're literally soaking in this stuff and drinking it and absorbing it, and it's having bad effects on them. So it's another reason to remember that the artificial contraception pill, in addition to the fact that it's very often abortifacient and a life is lost as a result of it, it's also bad for the environment. So if you're going green and you want to be good to the environment and love Mother Nature, don't take the pill. It'd be one less instance of that stuff getting washed into the waterways. And if you want to see a parallel to that, read this article. It's in The New Scientist, and we'll get that linked for you on the show Twitter feed, which you can access by going to relevantradio.com/Patrick. Let's go to Charlene now in Huntley, Illinois. Good morning, Charlene, and thank you for waiting.
Oh, hi. Sorry. Hello. I just had a question about baptism. Sorry. I had some friends that were both, okay, thank you, that are both Catholic, but they were married not in the church. They just had a, you know, at a venue. And now they have a baby, and if they want that baby baptized, is that allowed? Because my daughter just had her baby baptized, and she said that they don't really ask about the marriage or anything.
Okay. Well, they should. Now, from one parish to another, maybe there's some quality control missing, but the parish should inquire about that, because the parents, who are the first teachers of the children, the primary teachers of the children, they have to have a commitment to the faith themselves. Otherwise, that baby will get baptized and then be stranded, maybe for the rest of his life, without any further teaching of the faith. So the parents make a commitment when they bring the baby to be baptized. They're making a commitment that they will do everything that they can to raise their child in the faith. That means going to Mass on Sunday. It also means showing good example, because what good is it to have your child baptized? And I'm not talking about the sanctifying grace and all the effects of baptism, but beyond that, what good is it to baptize your baby and say, oh, it's so important that we get you baptized, and then they just never bring the child to church, never go to Mass or anything like that? It's self-defeating. So the church is, you know, the typical answer that you would get from a parish, from the parish priest, is if you're not going to be practicing the faith yourself, then no, I'm sorry, we can't baptize your baby. Now, we'd like to baptize your baby, and we'd like you to practice the faith, and we'll make it as easy as possible for you to do that, but you have to do it. You see, you have to darken the door of the church and live that life. And some people are not willing to do that, because some people, and maybe you've met people like this, Charlene, for them, baptism is purely cultural. Of course, you know, of course we baptize our babies. We're Italian, or we're Filipino, or we're, you know, Mexican, but maybe they never go to Mass and they never practice their faith. Well, that's a very shallow and superficial kind of Catholic identity. And that's not what Jesus wants. He wants us all in, as the saying goes, right?
Right. Okay. That's what I thought. And then when I had suggested that to my daughter, because it's her friend.
Yeah,
she said,
maybe
well,
you
they
can...
never even talked about it when her baby was born, baptized.
Right.
So,
right.
And well, it's the same parish that we go to, and I just wondered about that. If you know,
can you befriend them and maybe help work with them and encourage them to get back to the practice of their faith? Do you know them well enough?
I could try. I mean,
couldn't hurt.
I'm always on the edge of saying something, but I'm, you know, very clumsy about saying things. So.
Well, we all can be clumsy, but, you know, wouldn't it be a shame if you looked back later in life with regret? Why didn't I say something? How come I didn't say something?
Right.
You've got nothing to
lose. I know, that bothers me too.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thanks for the clarification.
You're welcome, Charlene. And this is a recommendation I strongly believe in. Why don't you encourage them to put the Relevant Radio app on their phone and encourage them to listen to this program? I've had other people call and say that they returned to a practice of their faith after being gone for a long time in some cases, because somebody recommended they listen to Relevant Radio and it changed them and God touched them and brought them back. So that's another thing you can try. And I wish you well in that. 888-914-9149. Now we'll go to Norwalk, California, a town I know very well. Let's talk to Judy. Hi, Judy. What are you thinking about this morning?
Great. Well, this is a deep thought that's been with me for a while, but Kel Clark mentioned something about it yesterday.
Okay.
When he was a Protestant, his pastor approached one of the parishioners. You wouldn't call them parishioners, you know. They're Protestant, but anyways, the situation was this young man was living in sin with his girlfriend, but he wanted to be part of the church. I believe that's what the situation was, but his pastor kind of basically said, well, you know, you're living in sin and, you know, you can't, you know, and I can't accept this. And he kind of walked out. They were in a restaurant and he kind of just walked out of the situation and left it like that and left the young man to think about it. And eventually the young man, you know, he came back and, you know, he did the right thing, but for me, it's like, gosh, I have people in my life that I'm dealing with every day. Like I have, you know, I have a goddaughter who is Catholic and who is pregnant, and she's having a baby and she's not married. And I fellowship with them. I have nieces who aren't married. They're not Catholic. Mm-hmm. And I have other goddaughters who are not Catholic. And like, where's my role in this? What do you know? Like,
Well, I think your role is to be, as Jesus said, to be a light shining in a dark place. You know how he said, you are the light of the world. No one lights a lamp and then hides it under a basket, but rather it's put on a stand where it can give light to everybody in the house. You're like a city on a hill. And if you've ever, you know, from where you are in Norwalk, just look north at the San Gabriel Mountains. And sometimes on a clear night, you can see, you know, the little towns and things up there from a great distance. So that's what Jesus is talking about. So my advice would be just simply shine the light of Christ with whoever you're talking to and encourage and instruct if somebody's open to instruction. Sometimes you have to admonish somebody, but be that light and be a resource for the people around you. And it may well be that this group of people or the one person in particular that you're talking about may indeed find his way into the church or back into the church because of you, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You sound kind of down. Are you discouraged?
No,
in some way?
I kind of feel like I am, and I think like they kind of do look, you know, like my goddaughter. She does look to me like that, like because I sent her scripture and I inspire her a lot, and I, mm-hmm. you know, and when she got pregnant, I was like, okay, good, now you can get married. You know, I was kind of like joking around, but and my nieces too. You know, they. It's just, gosh, am I don't know, should I say something to that effect? Like, well, you know, I guess not the same approach that pastor took, right? Like, what, do I have to do something as drastic as that? Like, well, to lead them to really deeply think about this, like,
no.
I kind of feel like I'm more, no, good.
Yeah, so in other words, if you're saying drastic, like saying you're going to go to hell if you don't come back to the church. I mean, there is a time and place for that. I mean, Jesus himself said that. He said, I tell you, unless you repent, you too will all perish. And he was talking about hell, not physical dying. So Jesus gave that mm-hmm. warning from time to time. But you notice that throughout his public ministry, more often than not, Jesus was gentle and persuasive, and he taught the people, he worked miracles, he showed them by his words and actions the truth. And every so often when it was necessary, he would rebuke and he would warn. So there is a time and place for that. But maybe in this situation for you, the thing would be to be passing out CDs. Maybe go to Lighthouse Catholic Media, for example. LighthouseCatholicMedia.org has a wide range of CDs. They also have digital downloads. But you can get CDs on practically any topic about the faith. And get some of these. They're very inexpensive, and you can give them away to your friends. Get good books and give them away to them. Encourage them to listen to relevant radio. Hey, I'm going to Mass this Saturday afternoon. Would you like to go with me? You know, things like that.
Those are great ideas.
A lot of things you can do.
Great. Yeah. All righty. Well, I feel much better.
I'm glad. Well, hang in there. Keep doing what you're doing. And it sounds to me like you're wanting to do more. So do more and put yourself out there. Be an evangelist. Be a missionary, so to speak, to these people. This is your mission field that God has given you. And you don't have to go to a foreign country or get on an airplane or anything. They're right there in your backyard. And you may be just the person that God has put in their lives to help them.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Patrick. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome, Judy. God bless you. Yeah, I mean, it's not, I would put it this way, everybody. It's not by happenstance that you know the people you know and work with the people you work with and have the people in your family that you have. And I understand that sometimes your own family members are the last people who will ever listen to you, but that's okay. I talk from time to time about the story of Philip in Acts chapter 8 and how God sent him mysteriously out into the desert to tell the good news to an Ethiopian eunuch who was reading the scroll of Isaiah but not really understanding what it was referring to. And Philip asks him, do you understand what you're reading? He says, how can I unless somebody explains it to me? So Philip explains it to him. He tells him it's about Jesus. And the man has a conversion experience, and he's baptized then and there on the spot. And then we're told that just as quickly as God had sent Philip to that man, he sent him off some other place to help some other people. So there's a miraculous sort of quality to this story, mysterious kind of quality to it. So my advice would be, maybe your son just won't listen to you, or your daughter, or your husband, or your wife, or somebody in your family. Very often that's the case. That's okay. Just ask God to send a Philip into the life of that person, and he will. And maybe he'll send 20, 30 of them into the life of that person. And ultimately, somebody is going to say something or do something that will click with the very person that you may have said the same thing to a million and one times, and they just don't get it. They just won't listen to you. Okay, that's fine. Pray for a Philip, and God will send him or her. And then maybe only in heaven will you find out who that was, but these things do happen. And I really hope that gives all of you some encouragement if you feel discouraged, because God is very creative in the way he gets through to people. Let's go now to Mark in Whittier. I'm going to get to as many of your phone calls as we possibly can as quickly as possible. Mark in Whittier, welcome.
Hi. This one's quick. My wife's aunt just passed away. She's 80. She was in her 80s, and her mom was very close to her. They're very, very close, very devout Catholics. And so she has passed away now, and first of all, the aunt told them, my wife's mother, that what clothes she wanted to wear for the funeral and those items. But now the daughter, who's a sweet person, very good person and everything, she wants to cremate her and then spread the ashes. And we're trying to explain to her that, you know, in the Catholic faith, and I don't know the reason why, because she's a very smart woman, the daughter, she's a civil engineer, and I want to explain it to her.
Here's what I would say. I'd say, first of all, the church says no to that. The church forbids that. Why does the church forbid that? Well, because it's not proper or fitting. It's not the right way to show respect to the remains of somebody whose body was the temple of the Holy Spirit. So the church, even until just recently, did not even permit cremation. It does now. It doesn't promote it or recommend it. It recommends interment in the ground. But for those situations where people, for whatever reason, determine that cremation is for them, the church no longer prohibits that. But the church says that the proper due respect for the remains of that person is, if you're buried, okay, you're going to be interred, preferably if possible in a Catholic cemetery in blessed ground. If you're cremated, then the urn should be placed in a niche. Usually it's in a columbarium. It could be in a funeral or a cemetery chapel. It could even be buried for that matter. But this is to show the proper respect for the person. Otherwise, you know, it becomes kind of frivolous. It becomes kind of superficial. These gestures like scattering ashes across water and places like that. That doesn't help the person one way or the other. I mean, that person is either in heaven or hell, or maybe waiting in purgatory to go to heaven. So what you do with those ashes doesn't affect that person at all. But it's for us, the survivors and family, and for that matter, descendants, maybe long after we're gone, who want to go and pay respects to grandma, but they can't because her ashes were spread somewhere, and there's no way to go and be present with the remains and pray for her in a particular way. So these are some of the major reasons, Mark, why the church says not to do that. So I would share those with her.
Okay. That's exactly kind of what I mentioned so far. But and with my brother, his daughter cremated his remains, and that's what she's doing. She's holding his remains. And can you be buried with those ashes? Like that, say, when she passes away, the mother, the ashes can be buried with that person?
Yeah, that's not forbidden. That could be done.
Okay. Because I had mentioned that too, and I was like, man, maybe I'm wrong.
No, well, you're not wrong in that regard, no. The church would permit that.
Okay.
The church encourages, though, that in the case of a cremation, have the urn put in a columbarium. And that way there's a plaque there. This is the name of the person, the year of birth, year of death, maybe any other message you want. That's dignified. That's respectful. That's appropriate. And people can come and pay their respects, which you can't do if the ashes have been scattered, as I said a minute ago.
I agree.
Yeah. I personally, and this is just my own personal opinion on this, Mark, and that's all it is. So for what it's worth.
Yes, no, I understand.
I find the idea of destroying the body. Now, this is the opinion I'm giving you now. I personally recoil at the idea of destroying the body with fire and destroying it through cremation. It just, to my mind, is hard to fathom why somebody would want that for a loved one. But the church permits it. So all I can do is share my own opinion on that particular point. I hope that's helpful to you, Mark. I really do. 888-914-9149. Let's take a quick timeout. We'll come right back to the phone. So all of you who are holding, thank you for your patience. I'm coming to you. This is the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app. This hour is sponsored by Ave Maria Mutual Funds, where financial goals are aligned with pro-life values and fund decisions are based on investment fundamentals designed to preserve and grow wealth without violating moral beliefs. More information at AveMariaFunds.com. That extra vehicle of yours, the one you're trying to sell, you could always donate it. Proceeds bring you more of your favorite Relevant Radio programs. It's easy. Just call 888-906-9069.
Get connected to the conversation. Call now, 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid is on now. Relevant Radio.
A blast from my past. I'll tell you what, that is an awesome song. Hey, you young people, if you're not familiar with Boston, get their first album. It's called Boston. I think it came out in, what was it, 76, something like that. Absolutely awesome album. If you want to be exposed to some classic, classic rock, start with that album. Let's go to Steve now in Los Angeles. Good morning, Steve.
Morning. I just wanted to ask, how much of belief is an act of will, and how much of belief is just a natural state of where you are emotionally? So, for example, when I converted, when they told me the Virgin Mary was assumed into heaven, I'm not going to lie, even now, years later, I still have my, I don't want to say doubts, but I'm certainly not going to, you know, preach the contrary or anything like that. And I will submit my own will for what's being told to me, just like I do for the earth is being round and me having never been in space. But how much of belief is just naturally innate as far as where you're at emotionally and intellectually, and how much of it requires a submission of, you know, okay, you know what, I will believe this. Where do you think that line is drawn?
Excellent question. So let's first define faith biblically. The biblical definition of faith is found in Hebrews 11, and it says, now faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. You know, as Jesus said, you believe because you've seen, but blessed are those who believe but haven't seen. So the miracles and things of that nature. So I think we can parse this in two ways. One is you're using the word belief, and maybe by that you mean faith. If that's what you mean, then I would look at it this way. Faith is a composite. Faith is not entirely based upon just assenting to something that you have no reasonable grounds to believe. You're just believing it because someone told you. But faith, especially Christian faith, is grounded upon evidence. But there's more to it than just the evidence. There's more to it than just what you can ascertain with your own natural powers, or even through divine revelation, for that matter. Faith is also a virtue. It's a gift. It's a spiritual gift. And so to have that kind of faith is something that requires more than merely amassing the evidence to support this. So if I told you Jesus of Nazareth rose from the dead, after he died on the cross. 3 days later, he rose from the dead and he appeared to people. Now, I can't furnish you with photographic proof or video proof of that. I can't in any way demonstrate that to you in a scientific manner, but I can bring to bear certain evidences, like the witnesses that we know for sure claim to have seen Jesus and were willing to die cruel deaths rather than recant their story. And if he hadn't really risen from the dead, why would they do that? I can bring to bear certain amounts of evidence, but ultimately the faith that's required, or the belief as you use the term, is something supernatural that bridges that gap. You see, as it says, it's the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. We didn't see the resurrection, and yet we believe in it. And we believe in it because there is certainly sufficient evidence to support that belief, but it requires more than just that. It requires saying to God, Lord, I trust you, and you have revealed this to me through your church. I wasn't there, I didn't see it, but I trust you, and I believe you. I have faith. You see, so it's a composite, I would argue, between the evidentiary aspect of it and also the trust aspect, where you are accepting this because God has revealed it. Does that get to the heart of your question?
Yeah, it does. How do you feel, just briefly following up, how do you feel about, you know, like, how would you feel if an atheist dies, a self-proclaimed atheist dies, mm-hmm. goes before God, and he says, sorry, God, I just didn't see the evidence. I just didn't believe, you know, based off what was presented. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to that? How do you think God will respond to that guy?
Well, St. Paul talks about that, where he says that the evidence for God's the evidence for God's existence is all around us, and no one has an excuse. That the evidence just from the cosmos itself is sufficient to tell us that God does exist. So I have a feeling that that's what God would say to him. I gave you evidence, you know, galore, and you ignored it. And, you know, that would be a conversation I hope I never have to overhear. Certainly, it won't be the case in my case. But there are people who have convinced themselves that God doesn't exist. But I think at some deep level, even the most hardened atheist may have doubts, or may even think, you know, well, what if it is right? So anyway, I'm not sure what else to say on that score, but faith in God is necessary for salvation. And whether it's an explicit faith, which I would say would be the norm, but if not an explicit faith, there must be at least some kind of implicit faith in God, because otherwise, you know, you're not going to go to heaven if you don't believe in God. I'll leave it at that. Well, thanks, Steve. Interesting question. I'm glad you brought it up. I love talking about things like that. Let's go now to Pablo, listening in Austin, Texas. Hi, Pablo.
Hello. Can you all hear me all right? Because had an issue with my phone.
Just fine. Yeah, go right ahead.
Oh, good. Thank you, Patrick. I have a little disagreement with some of the things that you say, but I do believe that you are really, really, really onto a lot of things. So thankful
thank you.
For you. I did have a question, though, in regards to love. And I just want to understand from your understanding, if we mm-hmm. say God is love, and I do mm-hmm. believe that, and married people, a man and a woman, validly married in the Catholic Church, love one another, we say that is a reflection of God, mm-hmm. that love between them. What then is the love that people who are not validly married in the church, say either a man or woman, or mm-hmm. even persons of the same sex, and they proclaim to have love between them, what is that?
So you're asking about people of the same sex who are not married or maybe not even Catholic, and yet they love each
Let's
other.
Just say, how about a man and a woman mm-hmm. married in another religion altogether?
How about two Hindus? Would that be a good example?
I think it could be almost any example.
Okay. So let's use that. So that, first of all, let's posit this, that the institution of marriage was established by God at the very beginning with Adam and Eve, long before any religion of any kind ever appeared. So it's a good and an important natural institution that is that all people have a right to if they're able to get married. So we can start there and say, in the case of two unbaptized people, the two Hindus, for example, It's a very good thing, and they love each other, and they are married, and we could say many good things about that, but I think what you're asking is, is it still considered good by the Catholic Church? And the answer is yes, absolutely.
Not that aspect of it.
No.
Is the love between those two Hindus reflective of the love that is God?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You would agree?
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, good. That's what I thought, too.
Yeah.
What about then, let's move on to, say, two people who are in a, let's go ahead and go with the, I would say an example that really brings today, love between two people of the same sex.
Well, here again, let's go to the issue of the institution of marriage. Now, by love between them, I presume you mean that they're living together or interacting sexually. It's not a platonic relationship. Is that right?
I would guess so.
Yeah. I mean, that's my assumption. So that being the case, I look to what Jesus said. And in Matthew chapter 19, he says that in the beginning, God made them male and female. And this is why a man leaves his mother and father, and he clings to his wife, and the two become one flesh. And what God has joined together, let no man put asunder. So there Jesus, again, goes back to the Garden of Eden to show the paradigm of love, and that is, in the case of marital love, between a man and a woman. And for that matter, one man and one woman in the covenant of marriage. So the paradigm, as God established it, is that. So to answer your question, I have no quibble with, or I don't deny the fact that people can feel very intense longing for people of the same sex. They can have deep friendships. But if something is disordered, meaning that it's not ordered toward its proper goal or end, then that is a distortion of what might otherwise be a very beautiful relationship, but because it becomes distorted when, in this case, when it's sexualized, that is a deviation away from that paradigm. So it's not as though people can't reflect or participate, might be a better word, in this attribute of love. God has certain attributes that he can communicate to us, not because some that he can't communicate on his part, but because we can't receive all of those things that God has. Some of them we can, and one of them is love, the ability to love somebody else. And that kind of love can be expressed in a full and complete and undistorted way, or it can be expressed in a partial way, maybe with some distortions. So rather than say, nope, there's no love there or anything like that, I would say it can be a love in a friendship, but it's disordered. And that would be the problem. Now, generally speaking, Pablo, I think that although there are any number of people in that lifestyle or in that situation who do have very deep loving feelings for their partner, very often it's not based upon love. And let's just say not in those particular cases, but in other cases, it's not based on love as much as it's based on lust. And lust and love, as you know, are two very different things. And some people will use the word love, love wins, and, it doesn't matter who you love. But in many cases, it's not really love they're talking about, it's lust. And we have to make that distinction as well, it seems to me.
So you're saying that they're not necessarily in love?
Well, I'm saying that there are some people who are not interested in love, they're interested in lust. And as I said a minute ago, there are any number of people who do feel a real love for the other person. So I certainly don't rule that out. But the same is true, Pablo. I don't know if the hang up here is homosexuality per se, but the same is true for heterosexual people. They're no different. You have a lot of heterosexual people out there who deeply love the other person. Man, the husband loves his wife, the wife loves her husband. And there are also people out there who are just playing the field and having fun. And what they might call love is really just a matter of lust.
I'm talking about people that have probably been together for 30 plus years who have exhibited through their life and everything a real, I could not distinguish that love between the love between a man and a woman for 30 years. So interesting. So you're saying then that.
Well, I already answered that one question. I hope you heard what I said, that there are indeed people who fit that description. So don't get the misimpression that I'm denying that. I agree with you that there are people who do feel that love.
Is that love that you're talking about right there reflective of God in any way?
I already answered that question. I said it can be a partial but distorted reflection of God's love. In some cases, yeah.
All right. Appreciate it.
You're welcome, Pablo. Okay. Well, that's good enough. I appreciate the opportunity to discuss it. That brings us up to a break. We're going to take it, and we'll come right back with more. The number to dial is 888-914-9149. Just had a line open up. You can grab it. Call me now, 888-914-9149. I'll be right back.
Compelling insights, unpredictable conversations, encouragement for your day. It's the Patrick Madrid Show on Relevant Radio. Have a question? Give Patrick a call. 888-914-9149. That's 888-914-9149. Patrick Madrid on Relevant Radio.
I like the old school music. That's great, Jim. Thank you. You know, I was thinking, before we go to the phones, I was thinking about that last caller, and I'd like to amplify just a little bit of what I was talking about love and people who love one another, even if the love might be distorted or even if the love might be disordered. It's not a denial that people love each other. And let's face it, as human beings, we very often have mixed motives in things, and we're attracted to things and people. And that in itself is a recognition of the good and the beautiful. And when you see something or someone who is beautiful and you're attracted to that person, that in itself, there's nothing wrong with that insofar as you're experiencing the effects of beauty or goodness. Now, it's not all, they don't always go together. Some people are very beautiful, but they're not good. Some people are very good, but they're not beautiful. Some people have both. So I was thinking about that during the break, and I just want to offer you another way of looking at this, where this might make it easier. Let's imagine that if you're a man, let's imagine that you are attracted to a woman who's very beautiful, and you fall in love with her, and you resonate with her personality. You want to do things for her. You want to protect her. You want to be around her. You want to share your life with her. You're deeply attracted to her, and maybe she feels the same way about you. But she's already married. What do you do with that? Well, you don't do anything with that. You can acknowledge how you feel and say, I am deeply attracted to this woman in every way. But it would be disordered of you to act upon that. And if you were to say, you know what, honey, let's go get married. And she said, well, I already am married. Yeah, well, you know, divorce your husband and let's go get married. Can you see how that now involves a disorder? There's a distortion there, disorder. And although she's lovely and although she has all these wonderful qualities and although you have these feelings for her, it's not right to act upon your feelings in that regard. So maybe that's another way to kind of look at this question that I and the caller were discussing earlier. And if you can remove the electrified fence part of the equation, which had to do with gay people, and very often people stop listening because they think they're being attacked or they're being hated on or something like that. And none of that was happening, of course. But if you can substitute terminology and consider it with a different category, sometimes that can help clear things up. So I offer you that for your consideration. And remember that to be ordered or disordered, another way of thinking about that would be like a satellite dish. If the satellite dish is pointed exactly at the satellite, it's going to receive a clear signal. If it's off slightly, it'll receive the signal, but it will be fuzzy. And the further away it is in terms of its orientation, the further away it is from that satellite, the more and more fuzzy and distorted it will become until eventually you don't get any picture at all. You just get, white noise. Well, that is another way maybe to think about what it means for us as human beings to be rightly ordered in our relationships, to be rightly ordered in our use of the beautiful and good things that are all around us, food, sexual pleasure, amusement, entertainment, sleep, you name it. I mean, all these good things that God has created for us to be able to use and created indirectly things like entertainment and such. But the point is, this hierarchy of good things is not a denial that some things are very good, but they may not be good for you, or you may not be eligible for that good thing, you see. So whatever one of these analogies is helpful to you, they're worth thinking about and they're worth sharing, because a lot of people, they never really think about such matters and they're guided more by their appetites and their emotions. And it might well be that you're the person that God has put in the life of somebody else who needs to hear it. And the more you think about it and pray about it and work these things into your own life, the better position you're going to be in to share them with other people. Let's go to the phones. Gerard in Menominee Falls, Wisconsin. You are up. Welcome.
Hi, Patrick. You know, your last caller is an interesting question, but I have to tell you, today is my 48th wedding anniversary today.
And congratulations.
An old-timer, thank you. And an old-timer at an early wedding reception many, many years ago, when I ran into him, I asked him, well, how do you do it? He looked at me and he just said, many happy, some hard, but all of them worth it. And so I thought that was a great analogy. Here's my question. I read a book just recently by a young priest who's only been practicing in the diocese for about 5 years. And the part that caught my attention was a chapter on his theology class in the seminary. And his theology professor told him to forget about what he learned about the transfiguration, where Jesus appeared on the mountain to Peter, James, and John. Mm-hmm. And he says that happened post-resurrection. But in Matthew's gospel, I think it happened prior to the resurrection, prior to the crucifixion. And I know that you teach theology in places. And so where do you come down on that? Is it a post-resurrection issue or prior to the resurrection? And the other thing that's interesting, John, who was supposedly there, in his gospel, he makes no mention at all about the transfiguration or even the establishment of the Eucharist. So it kind of points to me that maybe John wasn't the original author of the gospel by John. What do you think? What do you say about
okay,
that?
Okay, right. Two distinct questions. So let's look at this passage in context here. So this is in Matthew chapter 17. Now, to answer your question up front, this is absolutely pre-resurrection, no question about it. It's definitely not post-resurrection, and here's how we can see this. And after 6 days, Jesus took with him Peter, James, and John, his brother, and led them up a high mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them, and his face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as light. And behold, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah talking with him. And Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is good that we are here. If you wish, I will make three tents here, one for you, one for Moses, and one for Elijah. He was still speaking when, behold, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and a voice from the cloud said, This is my beloved Son, with whom I am well pleased. Listen to him. When the disciples heard this, they fell on their faces and were terrified. But Jesus came and touched them, saying, Rise and have no fear. And then they lifted up their eyes and saw no one but Jesus only. And as they were coming down the mountain, Jesus commanded them, Tell no one the vision until the Son of Man is raised from the dead. So there's proof positive that this took place before the resurrection, because he tells them that the resurrection is going to happen, and only then are they able to tell this story. So I think that cinches the deal pretty much airtight. So that'd be my answer to the first part of your question, Gerard. Now, the second question about the authorship of the Gospel of John, I go with the church's traditional teaching that it was this apostle John who wrote that. And the reason I say that is because John's gospel, unlike the synoptic gospels, it contains information that none of the synoptics have. And all of the gospels, when you set them side by side, they all contain a variety of things that some of them don't have, some of the others don't have. And there is a theory that Mark was the gospel from which the other gospel writers sort of drew from. But in any case, regardless of how that may have been, I personally favor the Matthean priority view that Matthew's gospel was the one that came first. But we shouldn't be thrown by the fact that some things don't appear in these gospels that you might expect. Well, why didn't he mention it? Because he was there. I'll give you an example. In Mark's gospel, which was, keeping in mind that Mark was a protege of St. Peter, and he wrote down the things that St. Peter taught him about the time of the Lord, you'll notice that anything good about Peter is absent in Mark's gospel. So even where Jesus says, "You are rock, and upon this rock I will build my church, and I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven," that's nowhere found in the gospel of Mark. And Mark received that information from Peter himself. So if Peter, he probably told Mark these things, but it's also possible he didn't tell him these things only because he was being very humble. That seems to me to be the reason why you don't see anything positive about Peter in Mark's gospel, because Peter must have been very careful and humble in how he portrayed himself. And the other apostles, or the other apostolic writers, rather, they include some of these details. So I would suggest that as a parallel, Gerard, to the absence of this story in John's gospel. Food for thought in any case.
Thank you. Makes sense to me.
Great. Well, I enjoyed our conversation. I hope you'll call me back again. Thank you. Let's go now to Rosina in Burlington, New Jersey. Good morning, Rosina.
Good morning, Patrick. My question is, where did God come from?
Nowhere.
Here's how we can answer that. No beginning, no end, and always will be. But where did he come from?
Well, the only way to answer that is no, he didn't come from anywhere. Because to suggest that he came from somewhere would be to suggest that God wasn't always in existence, or that he wasn't always existing as he is. So the only way that I can answer the question is he didn't come from anywhere. He's always existed. He's outside of time and space. Now, we can't understand that because all we know is time and space. We understand the idea of the past, and we look forward to the future, and we experience the present moment. But that's a limitation for us. We're inside of time. God created time. He's outside of it. So for him, for all eternity, God always exists in the now. Everything is now for God. There is no past. He doesn't look back and remember anything. He's not looking forward and wondering how things will be. He's not like us in that regard. And I grant you, it's very difficult to think about, but it's still true. God didn't come from anywhere. He's always been there from all eternity. What do you think?
And always will be, and he's always with us.
He's always with us. Thank God for that. We wouldn't be here if he wasn't willing our existence.
That's right.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Do you like to read, Rosina? Because I can recommend a book to you.
Okay.
Okay. It's called Theology for Beginners by Frank Sheed. And it would be a great place to start. And once you've conquered that book, it's not very big, but once you've read that, then I would go to his next book, which is called Theology and Sanity. He'll take you much deeper on this very topic, and I think you'll find it fascinating.
Okay, then I'll know how to really answer it when people ask.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much, and you stay well and have a wonderful day, and we love
you
your show.
Thank you so much. God bless you. Let's go to Patricia now in Sacramento. Hi, Patricia.
Good morning, Patrick.
Hi there.
My question is, if you would tell me when is the exact time we're free to leave Mass and having completed the obligation to have Mass and free to leave the church.
The general rule of thumb is once the priest has left the sanctuary, then you can leave. So they may process from the sanctuary to the front door of the church, or he might go out the side of the sanctuary into the sacristy. But to leave before the priest leaves is considered bad form. Now, there's not a hard and fast rule. I'll just add one thing. There's not a hard and fast rule where it says, sorry, you left right after communion, therefore you didn't fulfill your Sunday obligation. The church doesn't say that. but as a general principle, you should stay until the Mass is over. And that's, you know, understood that when the priest leaves, then it's time to leave. Go ahead now.
Now, if I had to leave for some reason, when would be the appropriate time? After the tabernacle is closed, or after he gives a final blessing?
Ideally, the final blessing. I remember one time where I had to catch a plane, and I was late, and I had to catch a plane, so I had to get to the airport, and I left Mass. I did something I never, ever, 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 ever do, and that was I left after Holy Communion, because if I had waited the additional 10 minutes or so, I might have missed my flight. So sometimes, and the Lord understands, circumstances make it necessary to leave a little bit earlier, and that's okay. But under normal circumstances, I would wait until the priest leaves.
Okay. That's what I was wondering. I am having a problem keeping my temper because we're having people stand up for blessings of anniversaries and birthdays and clapping for the choir and all of that.
Right. I can understand. In a situation like that, you would certainly not be doing anything wrong if you left at that point. I hope that helps, Patricia. I'll be back with hour three right after this, so please stay right there. I'll be right back.